Okay. All right. I'm going to be talking about a period that I'm sort of saying that it's defined by this idea of the chemistry of food, which correlates often with what other people have called the accounting of agriculture, the introduction of accounting methods, the ability to, or the interest in counting and enumerating. This is, of course, the 19th century, the project of the Great State, the period of the Great State projects. And another one of them that has received very little attention is this idea of understanding the chemical components of food and the agricultural chemical revolution of the late 19th century. So recently we've been talking about, I'm just going to sit down, I guess, get comfortable. We've been talking about a lot about how farms, about the relationship between food and farms. And I'm going to take that a step farther and talk about the relationship between food and soil, where food is produced. And one of the main characters that I'll be discussing was a member of the Central Experimental Farm in Ottawa named Frank Schutt. And I'll be talking a little bit about nitrogen cycles in Canada and about soil treatments, and then look at a specific case study of how soil treatments were implemented in the Maritimes. And so I look at several questions. I think, as Ian mentioned, I'm primarily at this point interested in biomass, energy, and fuel. But really we should think of course, food as fuel, fuel for human energy and for animal energy and for a lot of the muscle power that energized and fueled Canada in the 19th and earlier centuries. And some historians also argue that without petrochemical inputs into this nitrogen cycle, over 3 billion people on the earth today would not be able to be fed. And so a large part of our current population boom and growth, and the continued growth projected to 9 or 10 billion by 2050, is in large part because of the human manipulation of the nitrogen cycle. And so I'm interested in these questions of how will we feed 9 or 10 billion people? Are there parallels between how Canadian and Western agriculture developed and how emerging non-Western countries are developing their food-producing systems today? And also, a question I'm going to get at is, why didn't we manipulate this fertilizer and nitrogen system earlier? When you'll see the dramatic effects of it. Same people who argue this 3 billion or more people on Earth also say that over 60% of the nitrogen in our bodies in the Western world is from petrochemical produced fertilizers. So we need nitrogen. There's lots of it in the atmosphere, but our bodies can't use it. They can't access it. And so what we use then is, of course, solar energy and the process of photosynthesis, which drives the capture of nitrogen and its fixation in the soil. And then when it's produced when it's converted through photosynthesis into plant matter and animal matter, we eat it. So a huge part of our bodies, and I don't know if Jamie, I'm really curious about how Jamie's going to talk about the importance of the body, a huge part of it is artificial. And so we could look back even farther and say that, well, a large part of our entire agricultural system is artificial. And so in the late World War I, pre-World War I period, in the early 20th century, was marked by this fluorescent of course, pure food, pure drug, pure science, pure seed movements. But why not pure soil? People were, of course, the major consumers of the early 20th century were interested in buying land. They were professional pioneers. They were movers. They were acquiring land all over the place. But we really don't get that language in any of the discourses, pure soil. People seeking and wanting to know the constituent parts of their soil. And that's where the chemistry and food comes in. And so just to back up and say, why am I even using this term biotechnology? It's a little bit spurious because probably some people say the biotech sector is very recent. And now it's a massive sector representing over 6% of GDP currently. And actually, it's involved in some $80 billion of the economy in Canada. huge sector, much larger than agriculture in some ways. Agriculture is small and shrinking, is some, although not currently, because Canada is a food-producing country in a global recession. So, but we've all heard the adage by Marshall McLuhan that we shape our tools, and then our tools shape us. So I wonder if it could also be said that we shape our foods, and thereafter our foods shape us. And so food has arguably been the main technology of our species. For 10,000 years, we've been manipulating it through agriculture, and before that, manipulating it through fire, which, of course, brings a whole new range of plants into our food shed, and it makes it edible by humans. So just as we control our technology, it eventually shapes us in a sort of technological momentum. So some say that agriculture was the beginning of our current dilemma and sustainability in the world today, but some might even extend that backward several thousand, 100,000 years and say that the major threat to sustainability was fire. But nevertheless, the period I focus on is much shorter, as you can see. We're looking at the late 19th century. And it's kind of a big history, especially compared to the sort of micro histories and small commodities that I usually study, like flax and firewood. And now this is my first foray into fertilizer, so bear with me and I'll look forward to your feedback. I don't propose to, and actually I changed the subtitle in this version because I don't actually propose to look at all of biotechnology and all of the wide and varied influences that the life sciences have had on food. Or even as our panel title suggests, which is a nice title, but the science of food. Rather, I'm really more interested in the foods of science and how food and our consumption of it gradually evolved in the modern era, how producers responded to a variety of changing inputs and influences, and science just being one of them, one of many. And so I define biotechnology very broadly in this paper as anything that humans have been doing to manipulate the food system, and that, of course, increases rapidly in the 20th century, and the biotech sector, which I didn't bring a slide, but some basic stats are that as the first agricultural biotech crops came in the 1990s, where with genetically modified crops, and a year later there were 35 crops approved for production. A year later, 3 million acres in the U.S. were in production, and now 12% of the world's arable land is being farmed in these new biotech crops. So we're in currently a new period of food science and of a transition in food systems, and who knows what it's going to look like in 50 years or even in 10 years. But what I'm arguing is that this is another period earlier on. And today's biotech is arguably just the latest in the green revolutions. People speak usually of the green revolution of the 1960s, Norm Borlaug and the invention of or the hybridization of new wheat species that, of course, were planted in developing worlds. Before that, Canada had a major role in developing new plant and crop species. And before that, in the agricultural or the American Historical Review last year, Edward Melio has written a chapter called the First Green Revolution. And in it, he looks at fertilizer. And so I'm going to kind of stem off that. He doesn't get into Canada very much. So I'm going to say what was going on in Canada in terms of fertilizer and introduction of new forms of nitrogen into the system. So just as I'm going to skip over and show you just kind of a general description, just using Google Ngram viewer of kind of the terminology, the percentage, a little cut off on the side there, but the percentage of, the relative percentage and frequency of the use of the terms fertilizer versus manure. Of course, manure is high in the 19th century, drops steadily in the 20th, and fertilizer doesn't really even pick up until the interwar and the First World War period. So even in the discourse, it isn't all that frequent. But actually, this is what we see as far as nitrogen inputs into the soil. In the world picture, it's not important really until after 1940. So what am I doing talking about pre-1940 in this period, you might ask? Well, I'll bear with me. I'm going to talk about different kinds of soil treatment. And I'm going to look at what the Canadian federal programs were encouraging farmers to do for soil treatment. So this is the determinist story. This is the story where our historians of technology have said, look, this is why we exist. This is why so many of us exist, because of world nitrogen fertilizer consumption after the World War II period. So I'm going to say, well, what happened before that? And when did nitrogen come into, and when did nitrogen fixing technologies come into effect? And so I'm going to go back to this fellow, Frank Schutt, who was educated at the University of Toronto in the Department of Chemistry, and was one of the first graduates with that in that new program. And in 1891, he graduated in 1885. In 1891, this is a full half century after Eustace von Liebig's big publication in agricultural chemistry, arguing that we need to understand our plants, our agriculture, in a sort of chemically and scientifically rigorous way. You have to remind me, I forgot to start the clock, so remind me of my time. So, so over his long career as the Dominion Chemist, that's an auspicious title, right? starting in 1891 and retiring in 1933, he saw some massive changes in the way science thought about chemistry and agricultural chemistry. In 1888, so like I said, half century after von Liebig, in 1888, there was the discovery that scientists had isolated the nitrogen-fixing properties of legumes. And so this is one of the major parts of the nitrogen-fixing cycle. There are certain crops, legumes, that use bacteria on nodules on the roots that fix nitrogen back into the soil from the air. And really mostly only happens on leguminous crops. And if the crop is plowed into the soil, it produces even more and retains nitrogen in the soil. As if you harvest it, it still deposits some nitrogen. So that's in 1888. When that's really understood, although farmers, of course, were using this for almost a full century before that, and were aware that it increased productivity on the land. So in 1909, probably the big one is Fritz Haber, who looks a bit like this guy. I mean, I could show the picture. They all look the same, right? Fritz Haber, who in 1909 discovers the process of nitrogen fixing and producing ammonia through industrial and high-pressure chemistry. And that one discovery, especially in the last 10 years or so, have been pointed to by lots of historians of technology, saying that it was the major discovery that precipitated what we see in the 20th century, the development of nitrogen. Now, of course, the question I'm raising is, why was it so late? 1909, 1959, you really see the first spike in sort of world nitrogen inputs. But anyway, 1909 was one of the first ones. It wasn't really until 1931 that Karl Bosch, his partner in crime, who was originally working with him, but ended up developing this on his own, and developed the industrialized production of nitrogen fixation and fertilizer. So this could now be done on an industrial scale, done on a large scale. But still, there were other ways of producing nitrogenous fertilizer. So, and there are other ways other than Haber, which I won't get into now, but all coming out around the same time, 1903, 1909. These are the seminal moments. So when Schutt delivered his talk called The Chemistry of Food, which was to the Ottawa Field Naturalists group in 1891, this is a better print of one of the sort of ways he was breaking down the chemical constituents of crops and other places, soil. But in 1891, he delivered it to the Ottawa Field Naturalist Group. And at this point, Schutt was still trying to define his place and certainly his whole profession. With a master's, he was one of a handful of chemists in Canada with training at the graduate level related directly to his field. And in 1890, he was one of only 10 scientists or 10 staff members at the Central Experimental Farm in Ottawa that had any kind of profession or was even considered a professional. And when he became a division chief in 1903, he was the only one under William Saunders at the Central Experimental Farm who had a graduate-level degree in his field. The farm at this period was run by self-trained men, people who were optimists but ultimately utilitarian and practical directors of farm science in Canada. Still, he got along very well with them. He was considered one of the old guard, along with Sir Charles Saunders and John Fixter, William McCoon. And at first, when Schott delivered these talks, he was very wary of what he called the commercial fertilizers, the commercial plant food. It wasn't even considered fertilizers at that point. So he was of the under the impression that you could convince farmers to farm in such a way that could be independent of extensive inputs by adopting a scientifically balanced mixed agriculture. And we see this on a lot of the papers that were that are being presented in Kathy Wilson's today and Catherine's just now. The shift to dairy, the shift to animal production, the shift to beef in diets, and this is a period of intense growing intensification in animal husbandry. And so farm scientists in this period were very much in favor of encouraging this. And someone like Schutt would say, you shouldn't have to add anything to your land except for what your animals can produce. So that's in the early 20th, at the start of the 20th century. However, he did have some kind of crazy, I was reading this just downstairs in the OAC review, but he did also have some kind of interesting theories for how you could fix nitrogen in the soil. And he was, of course, a very strong proponent of legumes. You grow legumes, you harvest them, you feed them to animals, you take the manure, you concentrate the manure, you do it properly according to scientific methods, and you spread that manure in the fields as much as you possibly can. But he also said that, well, he was, of course, applying his science and saying, well, some legumes actually won't produce the root nodule. So what we have to do is introduce cultures that will make the plants do this. And so he had some interesting theories in the pre-war period about how to, like, shake cultures over the ground and make them do it, or even ship in soil from other parts of the country. And, you know, whether this was cost efficient or not is very unlikely. But, you know, shipping in nitrogen-rich soil to nitrogen-poor areas is... it's of debatable wisdom. But anyway, so that was called inoculation of cultures and soil. So I'm going to jump down to this is the Canadian story. Looks very similar to world data, and nothing really jumping until after 1950. And there were some other early fertilizers being produced. This is 1914, Nova Scotia. At any given point in time, there was only usually one or two or three fertilizer plants in Canada up until the interwar period. Here's one producing fertilizers specifically for apples in the Annapolis Valley. So Jamie might talk about that in the interwar period. So here's Schutt's lab. This was the nitrogen lab in the division of chemistry at the Central Experimental Farm. And so what they did there is what you might expect in a soil lab. They took in samples of all sorts of things that needed chemical testing. Soil was their primary area. That's what they're really interested in. But they also took in well water samples, and this was we've got great well water data in Canada, especially in Ontario, going back to 1900. People were testing their water and looking for impurities and harmful bacteria. So this is what the sorts of things they were testing. But here's a chart. This is the earliest one I could find from 1898 of 1 year of samples brought in. And there's really not that many, 287 samples brought in at this early period. But one thing I thought was interesting here is that the East Coast was actually producing more than Quebec and definitely more than the West, and not surprising in 1898, but disproportionately high for its population area. So what were the Maritimers doing sending in mud, muck, and marl to be tested? Well, they were interested in developing, they were interested in other forms of soil modifications and treatments, which I'll talk about next. This is an image of shell mud that was dug up by humans in the recent period. These aren't shell midden. This is actual recent shell mud digging in New Brunswick. And this mud was brought up to be spread on the fields. I think I have another one of Seminor use in Nova Scotia. Here it is spread across fields in Nova Scotia. This is lobster offal, sorry. So this is they use all kinds of products from the sea, seaweed, offal, fish and lobster offal, and shell mud. So the shell mud was full of calcium carbonate, which of course is not a nitrogenous fertilizer, but it's required to activate all of the other nutrients of the soil. Because high pH in the soils in the Maritimes caused high acidity, low pH, and caused productivity and fertility problems in the Maritimes. So the Maritimes in this period were expanding, trying to expand food production, and they were involved in this kind of discourse with Schutt, sending in soil samples, trying to understand how to better produce off the soil. But this had been going on for some time, and here's an example on PEI of sea manure use. And this is harvesting the mud from the bottoms of the river, which was full of all kinds of organic matter, but especially that shell material, that shell content from island and from maritime shellfish that broke down and added calcium carbonate to the soil. And so this became a really important, this became an important part of maritime kind of folklore mythology, a sort of natural balance between land and sea and treating the soil with an organic and kind of sustainable and seems like endless quantity of this fertilizer that was hauled up from the sea floor and from seaweed and other sources. But what I did was I just, the other part of this project was to look at some of the actual use of that and say, well, what were they responding to? And was it even, and was it sort of a traditional or sustainable form of agriculture? And so backing up to the very start of this period, this is a map that I produced of a food crisis. Sorry, I've got soil fertility up there, but really this is nutrition crisis in the Maritimes. And what you see are only in the dark gray or even black areas, was there enough food to feed all of the livestock and thus feed the people in these parts of Prince Edward Island. So just by count, just by basic, there's nothing really advanced here, just by counting up basic fodder and hay crops and showing that how much of the possible animal diet could be supplied by these crops, really only in the central part of the island. So there was a large disparity in the Maritimes between the use of fertilizers, as I'll show in the next slide, because in the 1871 census, PEI, thank goodness, wasn't part of Canada yet. So they recorded different things. Central Canadians didn't care at all about the harvesting of shell mud and seaweed and fertilizers, but Maritimers did. So they recorded it in PEI. And what you've got then is data that show how much mussel mud, is what they called it, or shell mud, was dredged from the sea, from the rivers to put on the land. And here I've just kind of shown that it was probably only in a two mile max buffer from the shore. So this is probably where all of that sea manure would have been spread. And you can also see that it's very similar to the map of animal feed. And there's a direct correlation for that. There is one primary commodity that people were interested in from soil treatment in the Maritimes, and it was hay, food for animals. And so this whole shift in the way farming is done, the way food is being produced, the increase in animal husbandry was reflected in the data for soil treatment in the Maritimes. And so to conclude, we didn't see nitrogen being added to the soil as rapidly and dramatically as we might expect based on all of the determinist arguments about how nitrogen changes the entire food system of the 20th century. But we do see other soil treatments going on, and we do see people like Schutt and the Central Experimental Farm talking specifically about other forms, legume, other forms of soil treatment, and especially mixed husbandry. Thanks.